RAAF is the second oldest air force and at the forefront of aviation for over a century. Be inspired by our remarkable air crew, maintenance personnel and support personnel who work tirelessly to keep our aircraft flying high and our skies secure. Host Gareth McRae, OAM, explores stories of humble men and women who, with daring and courage, established the Air Force as an Australian icon.
Vern Roberts reached the age of 100 in October. He's possibly the oldest living person who witnessed the signing of the surrender in Moratai with General Sir Thomas Blamey and the Japanese generals on the 9th of September 1945. He was born on the 25th of October in 1924 in Footscray in Melbourne. At the age of 18, he joined the RAAF in November of 1942 and reported to the Royal Exhibition Buildings, Melbourne, for uniforms. Vern V.F. Roberts, RAAF 120410 LAC Fitter, was stationed at East Sale Air Base only a matter of weeks after it first opened back in 1943. He was in a B-24 Liberator squadron, which was attached to 82 wing of 21, 23 and 24 squadrons. He spent time in Tokemwal, New South Wales and Darwin, Northern Territory, and the signing of the Instrument of Surrender was carried out on Moratai on the 9th of September 1945, where he was present along with many other servicemen. The general in charge with the other officers was General Sir Thomas Blamey. Japanese generals were brought over to Moratai from the islands for that great occasion. Every Anzac Day, Vern walked in the parade to the Shrine of Remembrance, along with a very few remaining gentlemen from his squadron. At the age of 94, it was the last time he took part in the march, and he now watches the Anzac services on television. Since 1994, he was heavily involved in the restoration of a B-24 Liberator in Werribee, Victoria. This restoration is the largest in the Southern Hemisphere and accredited by the National Trust. Well, it's a great pleasure to be able to welcome to our podcast Vern Roberts. Vern is a World War II veteran who worked on the B-24 Liberators. And this is going to be a great chance to relive history with Vern. Vern, how are you?
Hey, Gareth, how are you?
Exceedingly well, and a privilege to be able to chat to you. Thank you for your time. When I came on, you were talking about Werribee. What happened at Werribee?
Well, down at Werribee was an airfield, a satellite airfield to Laverton and Point Cook. There was a group of enthusiasts, old Liberator pilots and air crew, that wanted to rebuild a Liberator bomber, and they didn't really know how to go about it. This is back in 1992-93. So they had a meeting about it, and someone said, I think there is a part of an old Liberator down at Maui in Gippsland. And it was bought from East Sale back in 1948, just after the war, and brought back to this guy's home or his land in Maui from East Sale in two pieces, front part of the fuselage and the rear part of the fuselage. His name was George Toy. So it ended up getting taken down to a hangar, World War II hangar down at Werribee, and from there it's been transformed into almost like as if it was brand new.
Wow.
A lot of volunteers, including myself and quite a number of others, which I don't go down there now because I'm a bit older now. I couldn't work on the aircraft now, but I believe it's just about completed anyway.
And that's at Werribee, yes?
That's at Werribee, and there was 18,000 built in America by Consolidated Aircraft Company, and there's only 8 or 10 in the world today, and because the RAAF had 287 of them, and that's the only one left.
Oh, well, I am reasonably close to Werribee, so that's something I must try and make some time to go and see. But look, where I'd like to start, Vern, if that's okay with you, you actually joined when you were 18 years of age, because that was in the early 40s. What do you remember about Australia and World War II in that period? period of time which made you join up? What can you recall?
Well, I remember when the war started in Europe in 1939, and eventually Darwin got bombed, Honolulu, and then Darwin and what have you, and that all happened in Darwin wasn't until February, was it?
Yeah.
43. Australia was under threat of invasion, and as a kid of 15, 1939, and before I knew where I was, it was 1942 and I turned 18, and we were all required to say whether we wanted to join the Army, Navy or Air Force. So I was interested in aeroplanes, so I joined the Air Force.
Do you recall listening to the radio back in 1939 when Prime Minister Menzies said, "It's my melancholy duty, blah, blah, blah"?
I certainly do. I certainly do. And it was a shock to us all. Little did I think at that age that I'd ever be involved in it myself, and I ended up 3 years myself in the Air Force.
So as a 15-year-old, Vern, when you heard that announcement on radio, you and your friends, what kinds of conversations were you having as 15-year-olds?
It was one of those things as a kid, you didn't take a great deal of... Well, you took interest in it, but it didn't mean so much to you as it did to our parents. And I can remember when it got to the stage of when I was 18, I joined up, and I realise now as our parents must have felt, God, there were only kids sent away.
The tragedy of war is that it always affects the kids. When you did join in 18, did your training, I believe, at Shepparton Showground? Is that correct?
Yes, well, I enlisted in Melbourne, which was in central business area. And from there, that the day I went in, well, they sent us a letter to say that we had to be required to report in the city. And straight away that afternoon, we're on a train going to Shepparton Showgrounds to do a rookies course.
What was involved in the rookies course?
We were come under what they call drill instructors. It was plenty of drill and plenty of marching and also handling of 303 rifles. So that took only about 10 days, I think. And from there, they sent us straight over to Adelaide because I'd put in the first place when I enlisted that I wanted to work on aircraft, and I picked to be a rigger. Well, a rigger is working on the airframe of the aircraft.
Was that not East Sale Air Base?
No, I went straight from Shepparton
to Adelaide.
To Adelaide on a plane, didn't go home, and then went to a training school which is called a basic training in the city of Adelaide, and we learnt basic training of using tools, and from there they sent me to the showgrounds in Melbourne, where I did a technical training course of 2 months working on aircraft. And when I completed that training, I was sent to East Sale, and that's when we started to work on aircraft.
That's when you actually put into practice being a flight rigger at East Sale.
Well, working on old aircraft as they are now, Lockheed Hudsons and Beaufort bombers, and I think another aircraft was a...
Was that the Airspeed Oxfords?
Airspeed Oxford, yes. I completed my time there, and they sent us back to the showgrounds to do an advanced course. Once I'd passed that, it was called a Fitter 2A, which means A means airframe. By being a Fitter 2A, you went up and you became an LAC, was leading air craftsman, and they sent us back to East Sale. It wasn't long after that, a matter of months, we were sent up to Tokemwal, which was on the Murray River, southern New South Wales.
Was that your first experience with the B-24s, the Liberators?
Yeah, well, we did a crash course on the Liberator. After that course, we were formed into squadrons. Mine was 24 squadron. It was 21 and 23.
Was that part of 82 Wing?
It was 82 Wing. We were sent north. And we moved further north to Darwin after that to an airfield called Fenton, and these were airstrips just cut out of the bush. Our air crews were bombing further over towards East Timor and the Timor Sea, northern part of Australia.
Fern, if I could be rude and just interrupt for a second, I'd like to hear you tell me about your time with 24 Squadron. What were the other guys like? What was daily life like? What was the feel? Because we're in the early 40s. You're now part of, Australia's now part of World War II, and you're working with 24 Squadron, which is part of 82 Wing. So what was your time like in 24 Squadron?
I enjoyed it. We were young and adventurous. We lived just in four-man tents. Even our mess where we ate was, for the early days, was only sort of canvas and tents. No, we had a little bit of entertainment, not much. We had a picture shows used to come around once a week and show a film. But quite this, we had a bit of a break for a week or so and let us go and camp somewhere out in the bush.
Again, intense.
intense. Nothing else.
The actual involvement with bombing missions, Fenton to the north of Australia, where some aircraft never ever returned, can you relate some of those stories that you can recall?
Yeah, well, I've worked on many aircraft, and they had a crew of 11, comprising of two pilots, and navigator, air gunners, wireless air gunners. And, of course, when they would go out to bomb, you never knew when they'd come back or not. Now and again, you'd lose an aircraft, and you'd lose 11 men.
And you'd lose a lot of friends as well.
That's right, yeah. People that you really got to know up to a point, because you worked on the aircraft and they would be going out on a mission, and before you knew where they were, they had all their gear with them, and they'd get into the aircraft, crawl in from underneath the bomb bay and set themselves up, and off they would go. And we worked on the aircraft out in the bush in the sun. Don't have to worry about the melanomas and anything in those days. We worked in a pair of shorts.
Vern, when those liberators returned, if they were damaged, to what extent were you then involved in repairing them?
Well, if they were too badly damaged for us to repair, they would go to a repair and salvage unit. They had more equipment. We just worked out on the flights. What we did, we were like mechanics, looking after a motor car, but we were looking after an aircraft, that it was okay to fly off again. There was flight engineers, there was fitter 2Es, we called them, and they did the engines. And then you had fitter 2As. We did the airframe, which covered all the fins, the rudders, the elevators, the landing gear, and what kept the aircraft in the air. Then you had instrument repairers and electricians and armourers. So there was a lot of people worked on each aircraft to make sure that that aircraft was ready and safe enough to go off on another mission.
What is your feeling of the Liberator? Tell us about the plane itself. How good, how bad, what were its strengths, what were its weaknesses?
Most of the air crews said they were very easy to fly. They could fly for 15 hours at a time with extra fuel tanks fitted into the bomb bays. They could fly for 17 hours. They could fly for over 3,000 miles, and they could fly at 30,000 feet if they had oxygen. And they had a bomb load of between 5,000 and 8,000 pounds. And they had about five different turrets, just a front turret, a rear turret, upper mid turret and a belly turret and side guns. So they were very heavily armed, but they all claimed they were pretty good aircraft to fly.
It sounds like, as far as Australia is concerned and our field of war, it sounds like it was a very effective instrument to defend Australia. That's what the sound like.
Well, the Japanese were always worried about the Liberators because they did a lot of bombing and they didn't like the Liberators. I know I've read little stories about that.
So, Vern, all of that time, you're really on the Australian mainland. In December of 1944, you end up going to Port Moresby. Can you tell me how that came about?
Well, we went a lot further than Port Moresby. I don't know whether there was two or three of our squadrons of 82 Wing, but we were transported back further up to Darwin proper, to the harbour, and we were all put on to two Liberty ships. Now, Liberty ships were about 12 or 13,000 tonne, and they were built for carrying cargo. But these two Liberty ships were, and I suppose and others as well, were used also to transport troops. But there was no accommodation on them. Either you slept on deck, or if you couldn't get on deck, you didn't put down the holds. So the two Liberty ships with one destroyer, and we left Darwin, and one was named the Louis Arguello. That's what I was on. And the other one was the Cleveland Forbes. And we travelled with one destroyer from Darwin round bottom end of Port Moresby. All the way up there, there was probably plenty of activity with submarines and what have you, right up to the northern part of New Guinea. So we got to the little group of islands called the Halmahera Islands, and one particular island we were on, and there was teeming with troops, Americans and Australians and Air Force. Was Moratai. That was a strategic island. It had two big strips that would take liberators and fortresses and plenty of fighters. And that's from there they attacked and bombed Balikpapan and in Borneo and
Tarakan and also Labuan.
Labuan, that's right.
Yeah.
That's
and that was all part, I believe, of an operation called Operation Oboe. And those
Did a bit of reading, yeah. Operation Oboe, of course, from Moratai. The AIF, they took Balikpapan and Tarakan after we bombed Borneo out of that.
You mentioned the two Liberty ships, and they went via Port Moresby up to Moratai. That must have been a very risky journey, surely, with Japanese subs and aircraft, etc. Can you recall that?
I can recall it, but being young, we never thought of it much. I've thought of it also since, and all those years later, that we were pretty vulnerable. Two Liberty ships with hundreds of airmen on board, it would have been tragedy if anything had happened, but luckily it didn't. It was a sea journey that took about 3 or 4 days. We did see a lot of when we went through the islands. It was quite a nice little trip, but eventually when we got to Moratai, we were glad to get there, I suppose.
Now, I mean, when you're on that Liberty ship travelling to Moratai, it's now two or so many years later, you're now 20 or 21 thereabouts. Are you suddenly now conscious that we are at war?
I think we did then, once we got up there, because when we were down south, I'd say, Tokemall and East Sail, our thoughts were we didn't want to stay down here fighting the Japanese. We wanted to be up north, being young fellas, not married or have any worries in the world. When you think of it now, we were pretty close to action, although I was probably fortunate. I didn't experience any air raids, which was probably just as well. We were lucky enough. We were just that bit further back, because being on heavy four-engine bombers, you're a fair way from the action. They could fly long distances to do their bombing raids.
And those planes, as you said, were very heavily armed. So if they were attacked by fighters, then they would have a good chance of defending themselves,
They did.
You're on Moratai, and Moratai is a very important part of Australian history. 75,000 Australians fought in the 1945 Borneo campaign. If you make that a comparison, if there are 75,000 there, there are only 60,000 at Gallipoli and there are only 14,000 at Tobruk. So this is a pretty significant campaign for Australians. What can you tell me about that campaign?
Well, I can't tell you much about the fighting, but all I knew that Moratai was occupied by the Japanese quite a while before we got there. But that was part of where General MacArthur, when he left Manila and he said, "I shall return," he came straight down to Melbourne. And that's where he set up his headquarters. But when he made the assault, taking back the Philippines, Moratai was one of the main places that he used as a, because it wasn't far across from the Philippines, up in that area. So Moratai was a pretty strategic island that he was able to retake the Philippines. Well, and then after that, they used Moratai to further north, the Celebes and the group of islands, and then eventually Borneo, Tarakan, Labuan, and Balikpapan.
So he used Moratai as a basis of operations.
Big base.
Were you there for that entire time at Moratai, or did they move you around?
We didn't get to Moratai till 1945, early in 1945, because the war finished in August 1945, not August the 15th.
You've got a funny story, I believe, about that. You heard on the 15th of August, you heard a lot of gunfire and thought you were being attacked, but it really was your own people.
Well, although we were technicians, they didn't have enough guards to guard all the aircraft, because each aircraft was strategically placed along the strips at night time, and we had a roster taken by the duty officer, dropped off at each aircraft and stayed up with the aircraft at night. At this particular night, August the 15th, I was on guard, and about 11 or a little after 11 o'clock at night, I heard all this gunfire, and I thought, geez, the Japs have broken out of the compound. And I wasn't very happy about that. I thought, you know, the next thing, the duty officer come flying down the strip in his Jeep, and he let us all know the gunfire you can hear is the boys down at the camp firing off their 303 rifles because Japan has surrendered. The war's over.
Victory in the Pacific.
He didn't come pick us up until daylight next morning. Now, that was a little experience that I had.
And you were no doubt very much relieved to hear.
Well, war was over after 6 years of war. Yeah.
What I would like to do is dwell perhaps on the instrument of surrender. And if I maybe just as a little bit of background, you've mentioned there were three operations, the Tarakan, the Labuan, and also Balikpapan.
Yeah.
And I believe in Balikpapan that General Blamey and Douglas MacArthur were at odds with each other about Balikpapan because Blamey thought Balikpapan was going to be too much of an ordeal for Australians to take it back. And he ended up being right because there were 229 killed there.
Yeah.
But you still got it back. So were you part of any of that memory? Does that sort of ring a bell for you?
No, I can't remember much about that, actually.
Okay.
I can remember, naturally, the signing of the surrender because I was there.
Let's look at that, because a lot of people are going to say, hang on, the instrument of surrender was on board USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay on the 2nd of September. What's this other instrument of surrender? Because it took place on the 9th of September in Moritai when the 2nd Japanese Army surrendered. Just paint that picture for me on the day when that signing of that instrument of surrender was taking place.
Moritai was a jungle and everything was knocked out. To build the airstrips, everything was knocked over. Now, where we were taken wasn't a parade ground. It was a big sports ground because there was that many troops on there that they had to have some recreation, you know.
Sure, sure.
So this big sports ground was carved out of the jungle and we were taken there. And we were strategically paced right around on the outside. And I must have been pretty close because I had a little camera given to me by my mother when I left to go north. And I took a lot of photos, but I took the little camera with me. And I got as good a photos with my little small fold-up camera as what the war correspondents took with their big cameras.
Have you still got them, Vern?
I got them, yeah. They're little small ones, and they're all placed in a framework now that my kids, only in the last 12 or 18 months, have put together with the instrument of surrender in the centre and all my photos around the outside of the Japanese generals marching up to Sir General Blamey. See, well, he was a sir.
General Blamey, that's for sure.
Signing the surrender.
Could you actually hear what they were saying?
Yeah, it was audio, yeah.
Do you remember this? I'll just the very first sentence of General Blamey. In receiving your surrender, I do not recognise you as an honourable and gallant foe, but you will be treated with due but severe courtesy in all matters. I will enforce most rigorously all orders issued to you. Does that ring a bell in your memory?
It does ring a bell now that you're reading it out. It was fairly big amplifying system around, and we could hear that. No, it was a historic occasion. Now I think of it, at my age, I was only 20. That was in September the 9th. So when you look at how people pass away, there wouldn't be a lot of people still here, alive, that were there.
Mate, I feel, I can't begin to tell you how privileged I feel being able to talk to someone. I mean, I have a reasonably good history knowledge of the period, but to hear it alive, to hear from someone who was there, I feel so honoured to be able to talk to you, Vern, and the fact that you are sharing your story makes it gives me goosebumps.
Yeah. Well, if I can add a little bit more, the war had finished, but our aircraft, Liberator bombers, were turned into transport planes. I don't know whether you knew that or not.
No, I didn't.
Well, our pilots were used with very small crew, three or four, I suppose, and they were transporting prisoners of war and nurses and other personnel who weren't able to travel by ship, and they were flying them down to Brisbane and Sydney and Melbourne, flying back, pick up another group. It would take about 26 people because they had to put them in the aircraft in a little bit up the front, so many up the front and so many down the back, but they were just sitting on whatever they had to sit on, not very much. Of course, one of my friends who was a pilot, he's dead and gone now, he told me that he couldn't fly too high because it was too cold and the prisoners of war were so they never had much in the way of clothing and they were thin and they couldn't stand the cold, so he had to keep the aircraft down a bit lower instead of flying at 25,000 or 20,000 feet, to keep it down to about 10. When they finished that operation, we were still servicing the aircraft backwards and forwards as they came, and we never got home until I got home just before Christmas in December 1945. We flew home the same way, just sitting on our kit bags. Where the bomb bays were, where the bombs fitted, we had big, what they call luggage racks. And that's where we put our luggage, or whoever was flying in the aircraft could put their luggage on these racks, which hung under the bomb bay area. So I got home December 1945.
When you did get home, is that when you obviously at that stage, you were still in the Air Force. When did you resign from the Air Force?
Once we got down to Melbourne, we were down to Tokemall, and I think we ended up in Laverton, which wasn't far from where I lived in Footscray. They said, well, if you can just go home now, then we'll let you know. And I wasn't, we called it demobbed until April 1946. I was serving an apprenticeship as a printer in the printing industry, so I went back to work.
5 years later, or 8 years later, the Korean War starts.
Did you think,
I better sign up again, or did you actually say, no, I'll stay a printer?
No, I'd had enough for that. That was about 1950, wasn't it?
The other thing that impresses me most about someone like yourself, every Anzac Day, you would march to the Shrine of Remembrance until
yes,
what?
I did with my squadron. For most of the time, the first few years I didn't, but then as I got a bit older, I marched, and then my family, my grandchildren and my son and my daughter would come with me. And it was only about 3 or 4 years ago that I stopped marching.
And you now watch it on television, is that right?
I just watch it on. Oh, well, there's nobody left to march. The squadron's hard. Last year, I don't think our squadron was represented. No, there's no one left.
No, well, it's the passage of time, Vern. So
that's right.
And of course, the restoration of that B-24 Liberator. So you really are leaving your imprint or leaving your mark on a piece of history because you helped rebuild it.
Yeah, well, they made me a life member because I was there from 1996 till the next 25 years. It was like a big men's shed, and I'd drive my car down and every Thursday and sometimes on Tuesdays. And they're still working on it, and they're building two other ones now. They're building an old Avro Anson, and they're rebuilding an Airspeed Oxford as well in the same hangar.
The Airspeed Oxford was one of the first planes that you actually worked on as a flight rigger.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Tell me about those two planes, Vern, the Lockheed Hudson and the Airspeed Oxfords. What were they?
The Lockheed Hudson was American, and it was two-engined. It had been used as bomber in the northern part of Australia and New Guinea. But down at East Sale, where I worked on it, it was used as a training plane, training pilots and air gunners. The Airspeed Oxford, I didn't know too much about that. I did work on it, but it was an English aircraft. It was built of wood. But that was more or less for training pilots. It's two-engine, but only a very small aircraft, so not too many of them left either, I suppose.
It must have been when you started working on the B-24s, the Liberators, it must have been like going from a scooter to a super, super-duper car.
Well, we felt so, how could I put it, oh, Jesus, you know, we're going to work on Liberators. And that was a big thing because Australia never had four-engine aircraft. They had plenty of two-engine aircraft and American and Beaufort bombers, which were built in Melbourne, and plenty of them. But to go on a Liberator was a little bit different. And they built seven big hangars to take Liberators and Flying Fortresses and whatever at Tokemoor. And Tokemoor Airfield was built in 16 weeks. The Americans wanted somewhere that they could, because they thought Australia was going to be invaded. That was a strategic point near a railway station, not far from Melbourne, a fair way from the action, but the four-engine aircraft could fly a long way. So that was going to be a strategic point if there was an invasion.
Did you have much to do with American personnel with the B-24? Did you liaise with them in any way, shape or form, or were they just not involved?
We were pretty close to American camps, and I can remember they were well looked after by the American entertainment, put it that way. Of course, when their shows were on, they used to call them USO shows, and they had personnel come out from all over the world and entertain the troops. And I can remember this time particular, they said, oh, there's going to be an English singer singing tonight, Gracie Fields.
Wow. Did you get to hear and see her live?
Yeah, she was like a Vera Lynn. So we went over in the afternoon and put our little seats in place. And later on at night, all the action was taking place. We went over and sat down and we listened to Gracie Fields all the way up in Little Moratoy.
Look, you really are a very important part of Australian history, Vivian. You have helped make a contribution to keeping Australia safe. You should feel very proud and very privileged about that. It's a case of Vern Roberts shall live forever. He is part of history.
Yeah. One of the guys down at the hangar wanted to know my history. So I'd already written my autobiography to my kids. So I said, look, take this, take what you want out of it and put it in. So he put the lot in. So you log on to Vern Roberts, behind the uniform, there's my history.
We've made a note of that and I certainly will investigate it. And you're so vital and so switched on. When now you sit down with maybe family or whatever and you look back at your years involved with World War II, what things do you remember most?
I suppose the first thing would come to me was when I joined up. Dad wasn't very well. Mum was looking after. She was really relying on me and my sister because there wasn't much in the way of government subsidy in those days and Dad wasn't working. So she took in boarders. And I thought then, I'm leaving home. That went through my mind for quite a while, you know. Right. And I think back of it now, you have a kids of your own. It must have been pretty devastating for our parents to think they're away, they're gone, they're flown, you know. And as you have your own family, you think of that a little bit more now.
Do your grandchildren talk to you and ask you questions about?
Oh, a lot, yeah. It's surprising. It is surprising because I'm talking to you now that I would never have talked like that when I first came in out of the Air Force because we didn't talk about those things. My father-in-law was in the Navy and he was in Darwin on a ship when it was bombed. And my brother-in-law was a prisoner of war in Crete. And my other brother-in-law was in the Navy up in New Guinea area. But when I started to go with my wife, we never talked about it. As I think now, I would have loved to have been able to talk to those people about their experiences, but we didn't do that.
It's important that your grandchildren ask those questions because that's the way we remember. And it is important that we remember. Yeah. And having now me being able to chat to you, it's really made me feel very honoured to have been able to talk to someone like you who has had the experiences of someone like you and is so alert in remembering those things and sharing them. And I'm so glad you wrote an autobiography, which I certainly will be looking at.
Okay. That's life. And I was married for 69 years, the love of my life. Now, we knew each other for about 73 years. I lost her about 5 years ago, and that's life.
The beauty about that, though, Vern, is memories keep a person alive forever.
Yeah,
so you never lose your love.
Oh, no. We met at 21 years of age, and she was 93 when she passed away, and it's a long time, isn't it?
It is. Thank you for your time, but more importantly, thank you for what you did and so many others did for Australia. Thank you for your time this morning, Vern. It's a great honour.
Thanks, Gareth. Thank you very, very much. It's a pleasure. Pleasure to talk to you.
The motto of the Air Force is Per Adua Ad Astra. through adversity to the stars. Achieving the Air Force's mission is dangerous and sometimes deadly. Untold numbers of Air Force personnel perish and are damaged physically and mentally in war, peacekeeping, and civil emergencies. The Air Force Association's work is to provide these veteran aviators and their families with the necessary support services. If you can help with this vital work, please go to raafansw.org.au and look for the Help Us button.